This is the beginning of Class 6.
Phak means something left over. People call it remainder. I like left over. Same thing.
So I'm sorry, lack or che also, the
just
two of them?
Phak, just phak by itself means something left over. What's tupa? Do you know kind of tupa?
Tupa?
Yeah, it's tupa, soup. Tonight, no, soup. And you say, what's for dinner tonight? People say, tupa.
What's that mean? Realization?
Yeah, and you hate it, you know. Oh, Tupac means left over. That's what Tupac means. It means, you know, left over from the night before. People, Tibetans hate it. They go, Tupac again. They have it.
They like it fresh.
That's Tupac. That's how you can remember Tupac. People, Tibetans hate it. They go, Tupac again. They have it.
They like it fresh.
That's Thakpa. That's how you can remember Thakpa. Thakche, this che means having, possessing. Nyangde. Nyangde, you know. Nyangde means nirvana. Okay. The long form is, anybody remember?
Nah.
Nyangen le dipa.
Past greed.
Yeah. Nyangen le dipa. Okay, nyangde. Thakme means
not left over?
Yeah. Nothing left over. May means nothing. So this is the second and third kinds of nirvana. We had one kind last week. What was that?
Natural
nirvana. I forgot to tell you the other synonyms for that. They were in your reading. Did you notice?
Yeah.
Kind of nice. Natural mother.
Mother.
Natural dharma kaya.
Dharma body. Ultimate truth.
Yeah.
Natural perfection.
You tell me. Well, no, these are real nirvana. Okay, the first one was not a real nirvana. By the way, why do they call the first one a nirvana at all? Is this? And I've seen it in the scripture. Does it ever have any mental affliction? I mean, is it ever involved with mental affliction?
What?
Natural nirvana.
No.
Involved with mental affliction.
Right. No. Yeah, first of all, it's not a mind.
Right.
It's not. But can it ever be involved as mental affliction?
No.
What
do you mean by
it? It's the antidote. Yeah. So that's why it's nirvana. It's in a sense free of the mental affliction and their seeds from the beginning. It's never been involved with them and it never will be involved with them. And they say dhimmane. Dhimmane means for beginningless time. You know, for trillions and trillions and countless trillions of years, natural nirvana has never had anything to do with this nasty mental affliction, bad thoughts.
Well, it doesn't always have something to do with mind, anyway.
That's very simple. Yeah, it's permanent. It's unchanging. Mind is the opposite. Mind is changing all the time. So those are some big differences. That's why it could never be mind. But could it be nirvana? Could it be a cessation? Is there anything which is a cessation and natural nirvana at the same time?
We decided that. The Dharmakaya.
Yeah, the Dharmakaya. Mm.
But that was the only thing.
That's about the only thing.
So.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a big debate about that. I mean, one is a lack of mental affliction, one is a lack of self-existence. So they're not really the same in the sense of what they lack. But I debated that once to this Geshe candidate. We got lost. And all these old white monks were sitting there going. So these are nirvanas number two and three. But these are real nirvanas. What do you guess they mean, Fran?
I'm pointing to the book because something about after. If there's something left over, it means that they're mental seeds that have the potential to ripen in the future.
That's what you might think, but that's not what it is. It was a good guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't it when someone has choose nirvana while they're still in samsara and then they have to finish out their life first?
I told you last time, you can achieve nirvana tonight, or you could have achieved it a year ago. I have no idea. And by the way, that's true, I have no idea. That's why I have to be careful around people. With my level of bad thoughts, I wouldn't be able to recognize who you are. So, you can achieve it tonight, but you still have dirty... You still possess the skin and the dirt, you know, the blood and those parts of your body from before. They are... Are they suffering from the viewpoint of causes of suffering? Do you have any causes of suffering anymore?
They should be gone.
You're not causing any more suffering. But from the viewpoint of... Okay, you're not making any new suffering. In fact, they say that pretty much from the time you perceive emptiness directly, there are some convincing arguments, we'll study it, that you abandon the truth of suffering altogether. So people say, well, if you don't have the truth of suffering, I guess you don't have any suffering, right? I guess it's no, you still have no body. So, you're not making... It's impossible for you to create new causes for suffering. So you've given up suffering in that sense. But you can still have a horrible death. Uddiyana did. There were other arhats who had... You know...
But would it appear to us to be...
You can have a horrible death because of what? Because there's still a karma...
Past seeds. You know, there's a big debate.
What is there?
First Dalai Lama,
the heat are like the physical... The contaminated physical aggregate.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. Okay.
So what's the definition for you?
It's the definition, if you notice in the reading, if you do it carefully. And the reason I made the reading so short is that you do read it a couple times over, because it's hard. The definition is the same as the other nirvana. What was the other nirvana? I mean, what is the definition of nirvana in general?
A sensation which has
In their entirety. That part is the same. And then he says here, but where one still has the suffering heaps that are a result of his past actions and bad thoughts. So you still have the heaps, the suffering heaps, they call dinyantikumo, which are a result of his past bad thoughts and karma.
And that's referring specifically to the body that you have in
we'll
this life. Or does that also refer to, at the end of this life, there's still more heaps left over, though you didn't cause them since your nirvana, that you'll have to experience again?
No.
It doesn't mean that.
When you're finished with your body, you're finished with it?
Yeah, we'll talk
particularly
about
particularly referencing then the remainder of the last life in samsara.
Yeah. As I understand it, I'll make sure that I believe that. It's good, all the questions you ask me, I go to Rinpoche and I ask for clarifications. I got a couple of nice ones to do. But it's that's blockchain, that's the idea. What you have left over is what is still in, what do you call that? The inertia, you know, of your past bad deeds is still throwing, that energy is still throwing, that's still supporting this body. It's still making this body go forward into time. But when that wears out, then you won't have any.
But are you
anymore.
Suffering? I mean, even though you have...
It's a good point. There's a big debate. It's not an easy question. At the first Dalai Lama, when he wrote his book on the Abhidhamma Kosha, he said, you know, he gives a couple of examples of arhats who had horrible deaths.
Yeah.
One had his head chopped off. He said, you know, he gives a couple of examples of arhats who had horrible deaths.
Yeah.
One had his head chopped off. Udayana, which is, I know about, I mean, I read that book. He translated that book. It's here. He was murdered by his son. And it's interesting because at the moment of his death, he tries to perform a miracle to fly, to go up in the air away from the assassins, and he's blocked by his past karma. Because he wants to prevent his son from committing two of the five bad deeds, killing an arhat and killing his father. And his son is always quoted as a person who managed to do two out of the five.
Minimum.
You know, there's a question, can you do two of them at once? And that was the example. He killed his father and killed an arhat. We sent someone to kill his father. So it appears to me from my reading that you can.
You actually even
still suffer, but we say you've abandoned the truth of suffering.
But isn't it conceivable that you appear to be suffering, but you're not actually experiencing it that way? Because you are theoretically experiencing everything totally different, even though you may still look the same.
That's right. Would that person experience that death the same way as somebody
with compassion?
Yeah, that I doubt.
I can't
imagine. I doubt that it would be the same sort of pain. But when Udayana goes, he has given up his throne. And gone to live with the Buddha after he got the Wheel of Life painting as a present. He said, okay, I'm going. and then he stays with the Buddha, and then he hears that his son is acting up and causing suffering for his old subjects. So he decides to go back, and he says to the Buddha, you know, please excuse me, I want to go back and advise my son not to hurt the subjects. And then it says, driven by, you know, there's a nice word in Tibetan, it's propelled by his karma, driven by his karma to the final episode of being assassinated. You know, that he's, the whole incident of him going to the Buddha, and the Buddha can see what's going to happen. And the Buddha says, go, you know, your karma is driving you to this, to a certain state. You're going to meet something there, and your karma is driving you there.
But his thought for his son at that moment was a compassionate thought.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
His thought was
and
not
his,
suffering
his
thought, it was a
to,
compassionate thought.
To create a miracle.
Was a compassionate
was
thought
compassionate.
Also?
Yeah, it was compassionate.
So he wasn't really suffering in what we...
I can't imagine it, yeah. I can't imagine that they do. You know, it'd be hard to imagine.
But why did the Buddha do that? That's
also
the kind of, that's the kind of, you know...
I mean, they've learned how to do this purification. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that we can... have that kind of...
Yeah, I was going to say.
But isn't that kind of fatalistic...
Yeah, if you know that four powers, then supposedly a car accident turns into a headache, you see, and stuff like that. So
But why didn't the Buddha stop him? I don't understand that. Because,
like,
I mean,
isn't that the same? Have the power to stop someone.
Well,
if he did, he would have stopped on it.
But isn't that that kind of fatalistic, you know, well, that's your karma, just, you know, go get run over?
So.
I mean,
I don't think so.
No.
Well, if you saw it, the Buddha couldn't have said, you know what, why don't you stay here? Because if you go, your son is going to accumulate
that's the,
terribly bad.
Yeah, that's the idea, but maybe he saw that. You know, a year later, he would have, the same thing would have happened. I don't know. There's a story that Buddha's own people were wiped out under his, in his room. I mean, people took refuge in his room, and soldiers came in and murdered them. He couldn't protect them. His own tribe was wiped out during his life. Yeah, all around him, and he couldn't stop it. He had no power to protect them from it. You know, so there's a story that one of them tried to hide, you know, near him.
So there are two categories of what you got left over. You got your karma, which is propelling you, and your heaps.
Meaning left over, meaning those, the karma and the
seeds,
the karma and the bad thoughts are gone because they are causes. Once the result comes out, those causes are gone.
So then, what's
you don't have any you don't have any causes per se. You have seeds. You do have seeds.
There are seeds.
They were created by karma and
previous karma.
Bad thoughts.
Previously.
Yeah. And they, those karma and bad thoughts must be gone now because the seeds have already been planted. Meaning the action, those were created by your actions and your bad thoughts up to that point.
Right.
That you became an arhat.
Right. So you're saying when you become an arhat, your prior seeds are gone also?
No. And there's a thing called, there's a very nasty little thing called Nyingen Lemba, which is something bad that an arhat has that a Buddha doesn't have. And I'm not quite clear about it. It's some kind of propensity like that.
I understand what they say about karma and you know, some, he must have killed his father one time, I guess.
In fact, the whole story is in there, what he did to be murdered. And that's the purpose of the of those, that's from a sutra, that's straight from a sutra.
Okay.
That's the purpose of those sutras.
But what is it that drives the son to kill the father? You know, what?
why the person chooses
to do something bad instead of something good?
That's also a karmic result of having gotten the bad habit in your past life of not respecting life. That's another kind of karmic result.
Still, what makes you do that, though?
There's four kinds of karmic results. I mean, one is that you... One is that you get killed. Then another one is that you get the habit of not respecting life. So the son got the second and the father got the first.
Yeah, but what originates
then
that?
The son got the second later. That's another
thing. What originates that?
No beginning. No beginning, because any habit you have of taking life, if it's that, if it has come from a past life, then that habit was created by another life. I mean, those are involved with the proof that there is no beginning. And we'll get into that in New Jersey on Wednesday nights, if anybody has time. I mean, he's going to discuss the proofs for past and future lives, starting this Wednesday.
Well,
my confusion is that basically it's from the ignorance of not understanding emptiness, so you're propelled to go chasing after these dumb things to take
refuge.
That's
the root of all bad deeds. Yeah.
That's the, did you hear that? That was the answer.
Sorry.
That's the root. The main root is, as we've said many times, we're going to get to that at the end of the class. We'll talk about that at the end of the class. So those are two kinds of... Padmen Yangde means when you have no remainder of those dirty heaps, okay, those nasty heaps. And that's when you die, basically, in the last life.
Does that mean you have no seeds either? In that
somebody asked me that. You do have seeds in your mental consciousness. You have seeds in your mind stream. Some of those seeds, they can't create a new body. They will never create a new body or any new suffering. But you do have, like, seeds for somebody to shake you out of that condition so you go to Mahayana later. You have some deep-planted energy in your mind stream that it will happen that you can't stay in that condition forever. Something will happen to trigger you to want to go up to the Mahayana.
Those seeds are the obscurations to knowledge.
I don't think they're the same. No, those are good seeds, because those are seeds for someone to, for you to think someone is waking out of that state, and you go up to Mahayana.
This
Rinpoche's teaching, the Lama's teaching this on Wednesday night?
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that this Wednesday, and he's reaching a point in a book, which is the only place that I'm aware of, and the only argument for future lives and past lives. And he's just reached that part. Second chapter of the Pramanabhartika by Dharmakirti. Very powerful.
Do they tape this?
They do tape it all the time.
We get a copy of
yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Which brings me to a subject.
can we transcribe it, please?
Could you just define what a suffering truth is?
Yeah, hang on 1 second. Before I forget, because I got to talk about this. One of Rinpoche's main goals in his life is that we take his tape-recorded lectures and transcribe them and then put books out. And all those books are a result of that. And he'd like to do some more. And I thought it would be very appropriate if we helped. And what I thought was, between courses, if anybody in here has time and types well and has a computer, if you don't have a computer, I can even supply that. And we have transcribing machines. You hit it with your foot and it stops, and then it goes back a little bit, so you're always, he never gets ahead of you. And we bought a few tonight. And then Ariel's agreed to organize that in the New York area. So the tapes that we've chosen, we went to him and asked him what he would like. It's one beautiful series of lectures on the Bodhisattvas. See, because you rarely see them explained anywhere. Then there's a Kadampa, a mental training text that he's going to do. And then there's the first Panchen Lama, that debate in the mind between the angel and the devil in one mind. It's a beautiful, just really beautiful.
Did he say that, or was that a special request from
him? We didn't know about that book. I mean, he taught it.
No, I'm saying to have it transcribed.
Oh, no, most of the stuff is tantric. Or many of the things are tantric, or things that we've already translated, so we're not going to work on those things. And there was one more. Do you remember the last one?
Prayer.
Oh, there's one prayer to Manjushri for wisdom, which is only one take. So those are the four targets. And if anyone wants, next Monday, after this class, if you want to stay, and anyone who wants to work on that, and that'll be between courses, so it's not like on top of your homework, okay? Like, this will be the month of January, basically.
Do you mean that we can take the computer home?
I have a computer you can take home. Little laptop, very light, like a few pounds.
Because we only have three transcribing machines. We want to try to give them to the people that are the most competent at typing.
But if I had, you have to know.
What is a suffering heap?
Yeah, okay. There are five heaps to a person.
I'm sorry, this is under what? Oh, I'm sorry, Michael.
This is just an answer to her question. And people have this in the first course. But it doesn't hurt to go over it again. And I'll go over it very quickly. Five heaps, meaning five parts to a person.
How do you spell heap?
H-E-A-P, meaning pile. And the Abhidharma Kosha says, Pungdam Kego Riti Dum Pumbo Keti Kandam Yin, which means the reason we call them the five heaps are that each of those five parts is made up of many parts. So they're called heaps. And heap is a good translation. You know, usually I complain about translation. It does mean to pile something up. It's what you do to leaves in the autumn. Nowadays we're punging the leaves. What are the three great monasteries? The greatest is Sarah.
Sarah.
Sarah in general. Debung. Debung means rising. Debung means. So Debung means. You know, we always say to the Debungs, you know, Sarah means hail. And, you know, you put a pile of rice down in a hailstorm, come on. We'll wipe you out. So, heap. Heap means something with many parts. And the five heaps are, the first one is the physical part of your being. All the physical part of you.
Just a person or also animal?
No, any living being.
Any living being.
Yeah. There are beings in the formless realm who don't have the first heap. So it's possible to live on four heaps. They don't have any physical body. They're mental beings. So the first heap is the physical body. The second heap is feeling. the mental function of feeling, which accompanies every state of mind. You always have feeling.
Is that the same as the...
Without the stomach, yeah.
Is this the same as the consciousness?
Excuse me?
Is this the main mind?
No, this is a mental function of feeling things. And it's always going. You're that loose, that raw wire is never covered. You're always sensing. You're always feeling good, bad, or neutral.
You mean sensory, emotional?
There's two mentals, and there's you can divide it into three, which is pain, pleasure, and neutral. Or you can divide it into mental pain, physical pleasure, and neutral. So you can divide it into three, or you can divide it into five.
Make it the three.
Really address emotion, but,
yeah, no, mental pain is anger is mental
what?
Pain.
Sorry, thank you.
So that's feeling. That's a mental function. Number three is
discrimination.
You'll see many different translations for these. I can back up the ones I use with quoting the Abhidharma Kosha. And I don't think some of the other translations are.
It's so confusing, though, when we get
poor.
Into different.
They're very poor.
You'd right? never know if you're talking about the same topic, even. You know?
Well, on these five, they're often used different words. But you can, you're one of those. You have those three qualities of a good student. What were they?
Shut up! I don't want to hear about it.
No, what were they? Guess. Do you remember any of them?
Powerful memory.
Junior only has a strong desire to study to study these holy things. Mm-hmm. What were the other two?
Intelligent.
Impartial.
And impartial. Okay. Willing to listen, and. The intelligent one means you can divide gibberish from something sensible without a lot of teaching. I mean, you can sit down and say, come on, what is motivational awareness factors? You know, I mean, you know, if it sounds like gibberish, it probably is. The guy probably doesn't understand it. Okay, discrimination means the ability to what?
Distinguish
between two things. Yeah. This is good, this is bad. He's my friend, he's my enemy. He's a boy, he's a girl. This is red, this is blue. That's the function of that mental function. It's also a mental function.
So it doesn't have to be like a qualitative, it could be just...
It can
be
sensory also.
Sensory.
You know, blue and red. It can be judgmental. This is good, this is bad. It's all done by that heat, that part of you. Number four. It's called other factors. They call it compositional factors. It doesn't mean anything.
Call it what?
Compositional.
It's called compositional factors. It's a bad translation. It doesn't have any meaning. The definition of the fourth heap is Dvijepumbushileshin in the Abhidhamma Kosha. If it's good enough for Vasubandhu, it's good enough for me. 358. What's it? 80. He said, the definition of the fourth heap is that heap which includes all the parts of you that aren't in the other four heaps.
And that's what
all the rest.
That's pretty easy, you know. So you can call it what you want, you know. I mean, you can make up any fancy word. It's just Pumbushileshin. It's everything about Vajra that doesn't come in the other four numbers. That's a heap. It's got a lot of stuff in there. Come on. 44 mental functions, anger, jealousy, love. Attention. Yeah, I didn't give you number five yet. I'm trying to give them to you in the proper order. Number
anger,
five
jealousy,
is
love.
Main mind. Your consciousness. And you're familiar a little bit with that now.
Main mind.
We don't usually call. Yeah, it's six really. Mental awareness, eye awareness, ear awareness, nose awareness, taste awareness, touch awareness.
And then your objects, I read something.
Yeah, that's a long story. I mean, we're going to get to Abhidharma in about 1997.
I hope we're going to have a really good graduation ceremony for you.
Oh, you get a border board hat.
Get a hat.
I think I have a point on you.
The fifth one is
your mind.
So it's not your unconscious mind.
Number five includes six different kinds of consciousnesses. Your main mind breaks down into six types. Just your raw awareness of things, you can break it down.
Thank you.
This is also, being aware of being touched is main mind.
Okay, so if it's, you have your sensory functions in that, uh-huh. But then the first one's your body. Doesn't your body fit with your
body
awareness?
Contains the nerves, which allow your main mind to sense.
So it literally just means your body, just the blood and...
Yeah, the nerves, even the nerves, the optic nerve, the auditory nerve, those are all part of heat number one. But the awareness of that is triggered by those faculties is main mind.
So a dead body and a live body would be the first one. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to have any sensation or anything functioning to be a body.
Well, it implies of a person. That's no longer a person.
Living
these are the parts of a person. A body is no longer a person.
But it's just anatomically different
yeah,
parts.
Just, no, just stuff.
The physical stuff.
Is a dead body, right? Physical stuff. The physical stuff.
Aspect?
Just matter, as opposed to mind.
Okay.
Atoms, as opposed to that invisible stuff you call mind.
Thank you.
Looks like four and five ought to be reversed.
Now I'm going to answer a few questions about the five heaps. I didn't intend to do this, but it's an interesting question. Kylie, why do they? Do you remember why they take out of, why don't they have three heaps? Why don't they call it body, main mind, and all the little thoughts that go on in the mind? Why don't they just have three heaps? Why did they make feeling and discrimination separate from the other heaps? Why did they take out of 46 mental functions, why did they throw 44 of them into the fourth heap and pull out two of them and make them give them the status of their own heap? Do you remember?
It has a lot to do with your motivations and what you do and how you accumulate your karma.
In the Abhidharma, it says, Kori Juchi Rimguchi Pumbu Namne Sodam Juche Loshi Pumbu Shat. It means, Senjung Namne Sodam Juche Loshi Pumbu Shat, which means the reason we take out those two particular functions of the mind and leave all the other ones in that number four grab bag is that they are causes of samsara.
One leads directly to the other, right? And you have the mind, and you have the feeling, and from
you
the feeling,
the rest
you,
of these
you end
two.
Up
you see, I like
primitive.
This. You say, this is this, and that is that, and I like that, and I don't like that, and then you get in trouble.
But that's like a sewer. So
those two mental functions are troublemakers.
Which one?
I like this feeling and discrimination. He's my friend. He's my enemy. I like him. I don't like him. Those are the... And there's a beautiful description in the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma is dry. But when it gets to that paragraph, it's very lyrical. It says, farmers fight for their crops. Wives fight for their husbands. And monks fight for their school, and their philosophical viewpoint. And it's all because of these two mental functions, those are the
husbands fight for their football game.
I mean, this is what you want us to write? Feelings of discrimination are troublemakers?
Yep. I this is just to answer to her question. Now, why are they suffering? They're impure. They have been created by your bad deeds in the past. And your bad thoughts. Basically, the ones you were born with. If you are who you seem to be.
You don't really get rid of them, you just clean them up.
You just gotta sit around until they wear out.
Well, you're gonna go beyond them, or you're gonna have a set of.
You'll have
pure
a new
heaps.
Set of five pure heaps.
Pure heaps.
After you lose these.
So all five are suffering.
Yep. isn't that true? I mean, doesn't it cause. Do you get depressed and upset? And
it's proof of karma.
Until you're an arhat, you probably. Okay. Alright, so you still have those dirty heaps. Dirty mind, dirty body. Okay? The body is, forget it, useless. I mean, no future. You've got to end up in a hospital somewhere. If you're lucky, if you don't get run over.
No, Michael, these are Hinayana Nirvana there. We're talking about these two, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's, as you described it last week, or the week before, rather.
Liberation.
At the Mahayana Nirvana, for a Mahayana person, that's also Buddhahood. So there would be no remainder of impure.
No. We got to talk about it. She has a debate for me about it.
But okay, I mean, no. A bodhisattva who does get to that level eventually, uh-huh. and there's still time left before he becomes a Buddha.
There is. It depends on which school you're in. Big debate. Big problems. Lots of problems. We're not going to get into it.
So we still haven't gotten to Mahayana.
I'm not going to even think about it until we get to that. Because it's really limited for me to do. I'm teaching all this stuff. Okay. I'll just tell you one little detail. The highest school, we're in the lower part of the highest school, right? But the higher part of the highest school says that these two nirvanas happen in the rebirth. They say Hatha comes first. I'm sorry, Hatha comes first, and then you get Hatha.
Come during the rebirth?
Their idea is that Hatha and Nyangde, nirvana was something over, was left over, and nirvana was still something left is reversed.
Because you have nothing left over?
In a meditative state, perceiving emptiness directly, it's nirvana without remainder, and as you rise from your meditative state,
it comes back.
Remember,
all those dirty things come back. So you don't have to write this down, and you don't have to know, but just be aware that they think no remainder means no remaining conceptual thought, which occurs in a direct perception of emptiness. And then when you come out of that and start thinking again, you're kind of reverting. But we'll get to that in a couple of years.
Did you say that we have four, though? Four nirvanas?
Yeah, we're up to number four now, right? Mm-hmm. Then we'll take a break after that. Somebody asked me, we had those three tracks, that complicated thing that Kylie did a good job on, and I haven't finished for you yet. But somebody asked me if the two lower nirvanas were any different from each other. And I asked him today, and he said, not much.
Some schools say no, not at all.
He said there's a difference in the power of how they're attained. You see, from the point of view of how they're attained, there is a big difference. But the quality of that nirvana, I can't think of much.
Some schools say they cognize emptiness differently, that it's a coarser.
That's where we're going to talk about that. Yeah. This school said that. Okay, this is me.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So if you have no remainder of suffering heaps, does that mean you have no heaps at all, or you just have
good question. Oh, I love
heaps.
This question. Good question.
Keeping good question.
Keeping good question.
Oh.
I was going to get to that, but I thought I'd let you write this down first. There are Buddhist schools, and we don't have time to go into it, that say when you achieve nirvana, especially nirvana without remainder, it means that your physical continuum and your mental continuum discontinue.
That's
chopped off.
Your physical and mental.
They say that the lower Abhidharma says.
Say like number three.
And some schools say that when you reach nirvana without remainder, it's just the end of you. The end of your mind and the end of your body. They say it's called Bemri Ginche, which literally means the discontinuation of the stream of your physical parts and your mental parts.
So you have no more individual.
Well, then the higher schools say, well, is there an arhat?
Is there a
yes, there is an arhat. Well, does he have a mind or a body? No. Who gets this nirvana? Who's around to have this nirvana?
You just go pushing a little.
And then they get stuck, you know. They hang up. That's how the higher schools debate that point.
What do they say that you do become? I mean, that's what you lose. And what
they
you
say there is a person. It's very complicated. I mean, the Abhidharma system is very complicated. But basically, there's a cessation held by a person. Person has a cessation, but the mind and body are gone.
So a person removes.
Hello.
They call it Gope Nyomdi. It's a person living in a state of cessation.
So there's still a person.
They say there's still a person.
One way to get rid of suffering, get rid of your mind.
Well, that's the Western idea of nirvana, right?
Yeah, total extinction.
The Western people think nirvana means that, and they're not.
That's a Hindu.
And there are Buddhist schools that say something like that. So it's not so it is a little bit understandable that Western people have heard that.
Does meaning no mind mean no mental stream?
Right. Gimche means, it means the thing's been going on and then chup.
Okay, because I understood that...
That's, by the way, that's the wrong reason. That's the lower school.
Okay, I understood a fundamental tenet of Buddhism is something different.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a small, it's a lower school. It's not a higher school.
Oh.
I'm sorry. So say minete.
Minete.
Minete. By the way, the lower schools are not dumb and they're not useless and blah blah blah. We will study. It's a whole subject in Buddhism. Why do the whole lower schools exist? Why did the Buddha taught those things? Why did the Buddha contradict himself?
Because his early students couldn't understand.
Yeah, and we're going to study it. Oh, there's a beautiful book by Tsongkhapa. It's 230 pages long. A lot of people do not have to memorize it. It's how do you know? And what were his motivations? And how are we to know when we get a teaching, you know, is this A or B? You know, is this the simplified version or is this the real thing? You know, how do we know? Okay. Minepe nyange. Ni means what in Tibetan?
Not.
Not. Nepa. Remember? We had it the other night. I think Dean was there. Friday night. Nepa means to stay. Okay, to abide. We had it in a Friday night. And then Nyangde is Nirvana. This is the fourth and last type of Nirvana. So you can guess whose it is.
Buddha's Nirvana.
The Buddha's Nirvana. So Nepa means the Nirvana which does not remain, which does not stay. Stay where? It doesn't mean it doesn't stick around, obviously, because we still have it. It doesn't stay in sita, and it doesn't stay in shita. Okay. Where doesn't it stay? It doesn't stay in sita, and it doesn't stay in shita. What is sita, and what is shita? These are ta means what, you know? What's the ta mean in Rinpoche's name, Tarchin?
I say it doesn't stay in the Brooklyn or the Bronx, maybe.
You know, chin means gone, right? From Shiro Gipalo to Chinpa, Parsha Paramita. It's the ita in Paramita. Gone. What does ta mean? Ta means to the end. To the extreme. So these two words, ta in here, ta here, they mean the edge of something. The final edge. This is the ta of the table. If I put the pen beyond that ta, it falls off. That's ta. An edge, an extreme. Okay. C is a synonym for samsara. There are a lot of words for samsara. The wheel of life, what they call the wheel of life, that life there is C, sipikorla. This is the extreme of that we are in now, if you are who you seem to be, okay? That's the extreme of staying here. Staying where? Staying in this lousy life. Okay. No future. You get a new job, you get a new anything. You always lose it. No choice. No other option. Okay. Okay.
She
means. Now we're down to Shita. Shita would be great if you could get there. She means peace. Peace. P-E-A-C-E. What do you guess is the shita? What's peace? Lower nirvana. Okay, lower nirvana. Just hanging out in that pleasant space. Okay. That's shita. Not bad.
Boring. Yeah, come on.
How means
some stars.
Yeah, the extreme of peace and the extreme of suffering life. Those are the two extremes. This is the sita is the extreme of this suffering life that we have. Shita is the extreme of reaching a lower nirvana and just staying there.
When you say lower nirvana, is that opposed to higher nirvana?
Yeah, higher nirvana meaning Buddha. Oh. But just staying there in a condition where, what have you ended? Two things.
Afflictions.
And there.
Seeds.
Just, you know, enjoying yourself there.
You have seeds here?
Sure, no. Not for those.
Okay. Not for afflictions.
Yeah. Just to stay there is shita. That's also an undesirable state. it's a, in Mahayana Buddhism, they say, huh, what a big waste of time. You got to go up to the third path and do all that work anyway. You might as well go straight there. You know, you're just wasting time. Stay in that condition very long time, where you are having a good time, but other people are still suffering, is an extreme. To be abandoned by Mahayana person, to be avoided.
Yeah. So what is the state at which we have seeds which aren't being watered, and which we don't have seeds? Karmic seeds. I thought in the
well,
body we had seeds which weren't
you can
being
say
watered.
To have them and not have them watered. There's like, we'll get into that. Actually, I'll talk about it tonight. So, sita and shita. Nirvana, not staying, the nirvana that's not staying, is the nirvana that's not staying in either one of these two conditions. And that means the nirvana of a Buddha. He's not staying in the world of suffering, and he's not staying in a lower nirvana, where it's just, he's happy.
Yeah. There's a very big emphasis on that in Mahayana Dharma. Is there some huge tendency for somebody to just, you know, get to a nirvana and then just hang out there?
Yeah,
so there's this urge over and over again to drill it into your mind, bodhicitta, to resist that, you know, like...
Yeah, they say, don't... They say, anyway, you're going to be compelled at some point to get out of that state and go up to Maya. You might as well go Maya first.
What?
That lower nirvana.
Yeah, they say why? I mean, this is a little speculative.
Oh, they say it's a very, very beautiful subject worth studying. You know, what is the process by which you have some seeds in your mental stream that force you to come out and go up? You know, and it's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful thing. So that's the nirvana of the Buddha. Let me see if he says anything else about that. And obviously what you've done at that point is that you've What obstacles have you abandoned? Have you eliminated? You've obviously eliminated the first kind of obstacle, which is that thought. And there's the, what's the second kind of obstacle?
Omniscience.
Yeah, what we call obstacles to knowledge. So in the definition of nirvana that you had to write about in your quiz tonight, the person had abandoned or eliminated bad thoughts and their seeds. But in this nirvana, he's eliminated the other kind of obstacles, which are obstacles to omniscience. Don't say wisdom, omniscience. Obstacles to total knowledge. And that's really the function of those last three bodhisattva levels that we talked about. That's where he gets rid of his inability to know all things.
Can you qualify him like one? Kind of a little bit. We're in this Svatantrika school.
Yeah.
So, what the Svatantrika school? What's sort of their division of like what they say is and isn't as far as Buddhahood and Nirvana and all that sort of thing goes?
Long story. You mean there are eight things? There are eight beliefs which separate the two Mahayana schools, the two Madhyamika schools. There are eight points of difference between the two schools. And we're not going to study them right now. But one of them concerns what is a mental affliction? Is ignorance a mental affliction? What is it that you're abandoning at the final stages of just before Buddhahood? And those are some of the differences that separate the two schools.
The Svatantrika is Mahayana, right?
It's Mahayana. So of the two schools, the bottom two are Hinayana and the top two are Mahayana. And the top school has two parts in it, and we're in the lower part of that.
not a mental affliction?
That it is.
No, but are you saying that...
What they say, I don't want to get into it. We'll study it.
There are actually two schools of non-prasangika and...
Yeah, I know. There's two Svatantrika schools. You don't want to get into that. Have a break, and then when you come back, we'll do a short one.
Give us a break.
What
time is it?
Man means no self. Got this wrong in the final. Is there a self or not?
Everyone got it wrong.
Not everybody. Not a people. Is there a self or not? I mean, is there a Michael Rhodes?
Of course there is.
Of course there is. So what does no self mean? Yeah, no Michael Rocha's exists from his own side, independent of you calling me Michael Rocha, because you are forced to call me Michael Rocha because of your own past.
Simple. And thank goodness, otherwise we might be forced to call you something else.
You say that in an easier way.
Yeah. There's no Michael Rocha comes
from
his own side. There's no self means no self nature. No nature of my own.
Self-existence.
I have no quality of my own. Everything is imputed by you or me because of my or your past deeds.
So me means not and that means...
It doesn't exist, actually. No existence of a self. And the word self is tricky because this also has double meaning. You see? Itself, we say in English, right? The alter itself. That's what that self means. It can refer to things also. Self-nature, I think, would be a better translation. There's no quality that it has which it has itself.
Inherently.
That's better. There's a big debate about that. Nagarjuna said, I don't have to say inherently. Michael Rocha has no features. Michael Rocha has no quality.
Oh,
but it didn't get me very far in this class. I had to be so specific.
Dokpa means, you know what Dokpa is.
Realization?
Yeah, realization. At least we have a few pache from the first course. Still left over. I'm with Dokpa. Sherab, you know, Sherab.
Wisdom.
Sherab.
Wisdom.
Yeah, Sherab. He means of, it's the same as Sherab Kiparachino. Perfection of wisdom, right? But this is lapa and not perfection, okay? Lapa means training.
Lapa?
Lapa.
Oh, lapa.
Is that we're going to say tokpe instead of tokpa? Is that the possessive?
Yeah.
And what is it? What possesses it?
I'll show you. Okay. You read it always backwards, right? You ready?
Yes.
The perfection. I'm sorry. The training of wisdom, which realizes that nothing has any nature of its own. The training of wisdom that realizes that nothing has a nature of its own. And no nature of its own. We always talk about the guy at work being empty of being nice or being... inequality of its own.
But what is it that the definition says?
We're getting there. This is, what are we talking about? We're talking about the way to get to nirvana. That's our last subject. We have finished the definition of nirvana. We have finished the divisions of nirvana and the four types. And now we're talking about how to get to nirvana. And the book... Yeah, good question. Let's say the one which was defined in general, which we applied to the last three. Any one of the last three nirvana.
Lower nirvana.
Or
this is the same for the Buddha's nirvana or
Hinayana.
The
definition
doesn't fit them.
It's
only part of it.
Yeah, but it's true. I'll concede that. Okay. I can see you, right?
Last page.
Okay. First, you need three basic things to reach nirvana. Three things have to be going on. This is the first one. You have to have the training of wisdom, which is perceiving that nothing has any nature of its own. This is what I call the engine theory. I don't know if any of you were in that lecture, but. Believe me, spiritual things are like an engine. All the parts must be there. If it's the same as in the physical world. The spiritual things are the same as the physical world. If you have a path or a system or a religion which doesn't have certain crucial elements, you can never achieve the highest goal. It won't work. It just won't work. there's no reason to believe that spiritual things would be any different than physical things. If you go to your car and open it up and just take out one of the things and say, probably I don't need this one, most likely you'll take out something that will prevent it from running. And you won't be able to get anywhere. Spirits, there's no reason to believe that spiritual things are any different. They are exactly the same. There are a certain amount of elements that have to be there for you to get a result from a religion. And if any important one is missing, forget it. It won't work. You know, it might look like an engine. It might have a lot of, you know, people like to say, yeah, but this religion has a lot of stuff that Buddhism has in it. Maybe. But, I mean, can I sell you a car? Or will you get into a plane that has most of the parts of the plane?
This religion has great chrome.
No, I mean, the point is, it's even dangerous to have an engine that looks like a good engine, but some, you know, deep down inside, some essential part is missing. It's as bad as not having an engine. It might as well be a lump of clay. It doesn't matter. It won't get you anywhere. It won't start. It can't get you there. What I'm saying is, I don't say that you have to believe this now. But I assert, I say it's possible that in the spiritual world, it's the same as the physical world. If some element is missing, you can't achieve anything. You won't achieve any great results. You won't achieve ultimate results. Impossible. I assert that it's possible, that's true. You don't have to believe it now, but what we call Lam Rim, you know, the steps of Buddhahood, if any central one, if any major one is missing, forget it. That engine won't work. You won't get there.
Well, you can prove it by who they produced.
I don't know. I'm just saying, think about it. It's possible. So what
you
I'm
can't
saying,
get something from nothing.
For nirvana, you've got to have three things going on. Three elements. Three parts in that engine.
Is it to reach nirvana or to obtain nirvana? Is it the same thing? Okay.
Okay. Right? Thank
you.
The training of wisdom which precedes emptiness. Okay? That's actually the third training. There are two other trainings.
Oh.
Training. By the way, just as a side point, you have to write this down, but the reason it's training and not a perfection is you can have the trainings before the first path. You can have all three trainings before the first path.
You can only have a perfection after the first path.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why is that? It's not
perfect. No, not even perfect, but
it's not perfect.
A highly developed level of that.
Perfection means you do it with the view of emptiness.
Yeah, mainly. We'll get to that someday. But what I'm trying to say is, lapa means you probably have some form of these lapas now. Lapa is just when you're really trying to do. Lapa is not like, you don't have to hit the first path to have lapa.
You mean renunciation?
Yeah, even before you get through renunciation, which is what gets you onto the first path, you can have all these three lapas. You can be studying these three things. What are these three things? Lapa, Dhammo means first. And Ni means two. T-W-O. Ki Simba means, what did I translate it here? Under the influence of. Under the influence of.
Ni Ki Simba.
Yeah. Ki Simba. Maybe I should take this off. Ki Simba. So what it means is, not only must you be perceiving that nothing has any nature of its own, but that perception, that realization, must be under the influence of alcohol? No. I want you to think of that. Under the influence of alcohol is that so long as you're drunk, you know, you're doing something else bad. It's influencing, it's spreading throughout your body and it's causing some other bad things.
Well,
you can
start
but here it's the, that wisdom is got the alcohol of these two other trainings running around in your mind. What are the two other trainings? The first two trainings, okay, so this means under the influence of the first two trainings. The first two trainings are what? Wisdom is the third. Right. What are the first two? Do you know?
Yeah.
First two have?
Training. Now we got something new. Okay, the first one is morality. And the second one is concentration.
Trainings, parallel imperfections.
The more you study, the more you begin to see that they're all flowing in the same
way.
You can think of morality as keeping those 10, avoiding those 10 bad deeds that are in the calendar. What it means is, as you go to work tomorrow, you're really making an effort not to say anything bad, not to take anything. And we're not going to, you're not going to break into your boss's drawer of his desk and steal money. You might make a phone call that you're not supposed to make. That's just plain stealing. You know, you can say, well, there's circumstances. I needed to do it. I wanted to do it. These are the classical reasons for embezzling and...
What kind of amazing
thing? Regular job. Well, maybe you can't. But maybe you can. You have to be careful with your time.
In the whole thing in 1 hour? Or is this separate?
Minimum to sit for 1 hour without breaking in. If you want to develop concentration, and there's no other way. It's like, this is like dieting, or jogging, or weightlifting, or anything, or music. You must do it every day. You must practice it every day. It has no effect if you do it every third day or something like that. It just won't, you can't do it. You know, it's something you have to do every day. So make time.
You divide it up.
Well, eventually, though, you're going to have to get to about a solid hour every day. Somehow. You know, and you just have to...
start out at 10-minute intervals.
Well, I'm trying to get you to do 15, okay?
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
And
then you
I also agree. What I'm saying is it's not good to sit down the first day and try to do 1 hour. That's impossible. You won't. It's like trying to lift 200 pounds the first day you start weightlifting. If you want to build up to it, you can do a straight hour. So do 10 minutes, take a break, read a book, then go back in for 10 minutes. What I'm saying is in one sitting, try to sit for 1 hour. If you don't, you can't get concentration.
What are you talking about? Analytical meditation or shamatha meditation?
Any kind of meditation. Except analytical you can do in a chair at home, thinking. Mm-hmm. And you can be interrupted over and over again, that's all right.
What do you mean by analytical?
Analytical means, what are the arguments for... Why do I need morality? Why should I get morality down to that point?
So and, it's thinking,
think
really.
It over.
Okay.
Yeah,
thank
it's
you.
Just analytical meditation. And.
But I mean, so you're not referring to any specific type of meditation then? When you're saying
I'm talking about what will lead to shamatha. Yeah. Samadhi, which is meditative concentration, in meditation.
Which
is the training of concentration.
Which you develop by doing something for an hour practice. Every day.
Yeah.
And what is this thing that you do for an hour every day?
Practice concentrating on one object. in a formal meditation process. You must, or otherwise you can't. I don't think you can do it otherwise. That's minimum. I mean, ideally you should go for 6 months to reach it. But even then, if you keep a bad habit and you get better, you won't be able to do it. And it's just your choice, it does cut into your other time. It cuts into your reading time or your time with your friends or your time in your career. Or you have to make a choice. Because what's the result of each one, it's a flat choice that you make. You do have time if you want to. You won't be able to do the other things in your life as well as you want it. But if that's a... So what do you lose for that? You lose something that's going to go anyway. So it's just a flat choice. And you get schizophrenic. I'm schizophrenic all day. Oh, I should be meditating. Why am I doing what I'm doing? I'm starting to go back out the door and I say, oh, but I got to work on the computer.
It's hard. Very hard.
So that analytical meditation does not
doesn't
count
have to occur in a formal... Yeah.
As far as going towards that concentration.
It can if you go into a formal posture.
Oh, I see. The posture is part of that.
Yeah. And if about the posture, there are 7 points to the posture. There are 7 characteristics of the posture. And if you can't do, if you physically get into that posture and your body hurts so bad, that you're distracted by it, you are required to change. You know, you're not allowed to stay in that posture. So, you know, it's not to say you should suffer, because I think when you get good at that, you realize that you, you know, you shouldn't, you're not allowed to push it when it's not going well. And you're not allowed to slack off when it's going well.
So are those two separate definitions?
Now we're getting three steps you've got to have to get nirvana. First, you must have wisdom that perceives emptiness. Secondly, it must be under the influence of fine-tuned morality and fine-tuned concentration. And it's got to be under that influence in the way that you are when you're drunk and you're driving a car and it's weaving around.
So when you define concentration, you define it as sitting in the seven-point posture.
Yeah.
And either doing
one point in
meditation or analytical meditation.
Right.
Fine-tuned.
It's a wonderful preliminary. If you know, chess players have this.
I was gonna say when you play, when you go to these chess parlors, they're sitting there. Their bodies are almost their residue. Their minds are so into the concentration.
And that's, you know, they are still having. They're not focusing on one picture in their mind, but that concentration is defined as a single point in mind. My boss has concentration on money. He has it. So he has incredible powers of concentration. He can. You know, we were with him in Japan, and he didn't eat for 24 hours, and he didn't sleep. And, you know, we went into a coffee shop, and we were hoping he would give us something to eat. And he drank the coffee, ate like 12 packs of sugar, and he got up and kept going. You know? And he has concentration. It's not a good option. It's not a useful one. Okay, talk soon about that. Tolkien's what?
Emptiness?
Nah.
Yeah. Oh, realization.
Yeah, realization. Yeah. Sin we have up here, same word, different meaning, okay? This sin means already. Komba means to get used to habituate yourself. This is the root for the word for meditation, not spelled the same. Komba. And the other one is gomba. Okay. Komba. Komba means to get used to something, to habituate yourself to something. Does that relate to any one of the paths?
Meditation.
What?
Habituation.
Habituation, okay. Mm-hmm. So this last part of the method for getting to nirvana.
Training, no?
Well, the last of the three things you need to reach nirvana. It's not a training.
Oh, it's not a training.
No. We're not defining the training. The first part of our path to get to nirvana, we talked about the third training. And then in the second part, we talked about the second two trainings. We said that the first training has to be under the influence of the other two trainings. And then the third point is that you have to get used to what you perceived. You have to get used to what you realized, what you already realized. You have to get used to what you already realized.
That's assuming you've already realized it.
Right, directly. So he's mainly talking about which path?
Well, after the path of sin.
Right, and before the path of no more me. He's talking about the fourth path.
So
the fourth path is defined, essentially, as getting used to what you perceived, or what you realized when?
New direct
perception. After new perception.
Yeah. Okay. the whole period between that beautiful few minutes or whatever that you perceive emptiness directly for the first time, and then the period that you finally get rid of all your bad thoughts, that whole period is this. It's getting used to what you saw before directly. It's getting running over it again and again and reviewing it again and again and using that realization in your daily life.
Yeah, but I think you're leaving something out here, right? We haven't discussed it yet in the class, but you and I have discussed it before. This is a process where the person continually goes back and perceives emptiness again and again over and over again. Right?
That's how it's described.
It's not like the one, so far in the class, we haven't mentioned this, but it's not like a one-shot deal. You perceive emptiness and then you spend a great deal of time afterwards getting used to that one perception that you had.
It is largely that also, but technically it's defined as getting. It does involve going back into that deep state and seeing it again directly
as you can.
But this is not just that. This is also in your daily life, applying it in your daily life. Yeah.
That's right. But while you're not in it now, to change your relative reality.
What will be your main thought during that time, according to those four bodhicittas we talked about? He can no longer see or think what?
Well, during
this period,
the habituation, you're changing this way you see relative reality.
No. During that period, does he believe in what he sees?
Yes.
No.
He doesn't believe he's right. He believes he's wrong. Right. He understands that he's wrong, but does he still see it?
Yes.
And this is what we call illusion. And that's the only meaning of illusion. I mean, this is the principal meaning of illusion in Buddhism. Okay. All that other stuff is, sounds nice, doesn't mean anything. Okay? This is the main meaning of illusion. He knows he's crazy. He knows he's not seeing things right. He doesn't believe what he's seeing anymore. And he's getting used to that idea. And he's using that to be more moral. And he's using that to get rid of his ignorance.
In the homework, I asked you... when we were speaking about the four levels of bodhicitta.
Let's call it the four kinds of bodhicitta.
Okay, so the four types of bodhicitta, and then we talked about the third. The third type differs from the second type in that the perceiver has directly perceived emptiness and is working, I guess I'm saying this wrong, is working on perceiving it all the time, but doesn't exactly have that same perception.
No, it's not that he perceives emptiness directly all the time. It's that he no longer sees things as self-existent.
But that's at the second
type. The third one.
He no longer believes.
At the second one, he no longer believes himself. At the third one, he no longer sees.
But if he doesn't see them as inherently existent, and he doesn't see them as empty, how does he see them?
That's a good question. I got to think about that.
He's
not a Buddha yet. He's not a Buddha. He can't perceive them as being human beings.
Nothing appears to him when he.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll have to ask.
You said the difference between that person and the Buddha was that the Buddha didn't have the seeds to see them anymore.
Right?
That's why I asked.
She's saying if he doesn't have the seeds,
he can't see.
The seeds aren't doing anything, then can he still perceive relative reality?
Well, yeah, you said that the seeds were there, they weren't doing anything, but, the difference be...
But he's not perceiving, he just said that this person is not perceiving emptiness directly all the time, that's not what he's saying.
No, not at all, no.
So, he hasn't totally gotten...
Yeah, but then you said that the...
What do you want, you have a thing in logic called pulsama.
Wait a minute.
If he's not seeing them as empty,
right,
and he's not seeing them wrong anymore, what's left?
Yeah.
What is he? What's going on?
But you said that the path of no more learning was also synonymous with Buddhahood, so that's the answer to the question. At the end of this process, then you're on the last path.
At the end,
she's talking about Bhumi's 8, 9, and 10.
The third level.
She's talking about the third type. That's a good question.
What about
Let me cook it. By the way, part of the answer I know. Part of the answer is that in this school, what I told you about the last three levels is mostly Prasangika.
Last three levels? You mean four kinds?
What I told you is mostly Prasangika. The Satantika, according to Rinpoche, asked him. I mean, they still believe he has some kind of seeing things as but I don't want to get into it.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, the Buddha sees things as both empty and deceptive simultaneously. He sees both natures. So perhaps in this case, you know, he is seeing one of those two realities all the time, but not both.
Is he in meditation on the last few dreams all the time? I don't know.
Then you don't have to be in meditation to see emptiness at that point.
Maybe not. Let me ask Swimperson. That's a tough question. That's a good question. Yeah.
Back to what I was asking you about before, that this person is just going back and perceiving emptiness continually, mm-hmm. more and more, mm-hmm. To use that perception and this relative experience that they're having. Do they also encounter a Buddha on the way back out of their subsequent perceptions of emptiness, or is it only the first time?
Does he re-see the Four Noble Truths is what you're saying, right? If you go through that process, when he comes down out of that perception, I don't know.
No. I'm talking about the way you used to say that person will meet a Buddha face to face. The Buddha will say, you will become a Buddha yourself, and such and thus the time.
No, not like that. He doesn't like stand there and say, you'll become a Buddha. You understand that it's going to take that many lives. It's one of the knowledges you get, but it's not that the Buddha comes, we call it Ling Dhamma. It's not that he appears to you in some vision and he says, hey, Michael, you know, only 7 lives left. It's not like that.
But
you perceive the Buddha's Dhammakaya. Mainly.
Okay, so then you perceive the Dhammakaya every time you've had this perception of emptiness on the way?
Directly.
And could you also learn from that experience as well as the experience of the
emptiness? I assume
emptiness?
You can.
In other words, there's a teaching going on at some very high level that the Buddha would be teaching you very
well. I don't think a conscious teaching. No, Dhammakaya is emptiness.
Yeah.
You're still seeing emptiness. You don't know it's emptiness until you come out. Alright, we should go. Any other questions? No.
Okay.
So,
homework. When you got an hour of meditation, do you have to go all at the same time?
Excuse me?
1 hour meditation.
It's my personal experience that it's very preferable to make it the same time every day. Because your friends get to learn. Your friends get to know that if they call you and there's nobody going to answer your phone, if they bang on the door and you're not going to answer them, you get in the habit of not delaying until the end of the day when you're tired and exhausted and you're not going to have any results. If you do it the same time every day for years, just Benjamin Franklin said, let the world adjust to my schedule. You know, I'm tired of adjusting. The world is endless. I mean, these things go on and on. There's always a problem to be addressed. If I was a phone call, is everybody something
needs to have holes in it.
I know. And I did it at the last minute because I had no time.
Punch them before you take
you
punch
them. You want to fill them.
These three things that you need to get to Nirvana now, it seems like one thing
that you need to do.
It is. I gotta go turn it on. Good night.
This is the end of Class 6.